Top stories: political prisoners in Bahrain continue a hunger strike for a fifth day amid worsening prison conditions. Palestinians bid farewell to another young man killed by the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank city of Tulkarm as fresh clashes erupt in Kafr Kadu. And China slams U.S. for frequently violating World Trade Organization rules and damaging interests of other WTO member states. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Political prisoners in Bahrain are continuing their hunger strike for a fifth day now. The prisoners have several grievances, including a ban on worshipping and lack of adequate health care. Bahraini rights activists say that two blocks at the Jaw prison launched a strike Monday. Three others began their strike on Tuesday. Some inmates have been recounting their plight from inside the prison. Prison administration has yet to agree to launch dialogue with prisoners to discuss their demands. There are more than 1,300 prisoners of conscience in Bahrain. The country is in the midst of a decade-long crackdown on a Shia majority and other communities demanding more political freedom. Massive protests first erupted in 2011. At the time, the kingdom cracked down on demonstrations with the help of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. In the occupied West Bank, a funeral has been held for another Palestinian killed by Israeli forces. Mourners in Tulkarm chanted slogans demanding a ramping up of resistance against Israel. Mahmoud Jarad succumbed to a gunshot wound to the chest, which he sustained during an Israeli raid on the refugee camp there in the city. The incursion also left at least 8 Palestinians wounded. The Hamas resistance movement stressed that resistance will continue, vowing Israel's crimes will not go unpunished. Meanwhile, 4 Palestinians have been wounded in clashes with Israeli forces in the town of Kafr Kadum. Israeli troops carry out attacks against Palestinian cities and towns throughout the West Bank almost on a daily basis. Meanwhile, Palestinians hold a rally in the besieged Gaza Strip to condemn escalating Israeli violations against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They also express support for resistance in the occupied West Bank. Our correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, has your details from Gaza.
People rallied in the Gaza Strip following Friday prayers in solidarity with Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinians decried the Israeli crimes in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank. In recent weeks, settlers backed by Israeli forces have repeatedly violated the sanctity of Al-Quds. Israeli forces also carry out daily attacks in the occupied West Bank. They have killed some 200 Palestinians since the beginning of this year. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which organized the rally, warned the Israeli regime of the consequences of violations in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank.
The Palestinian people and the resistance are closely monitoring the aggression of the Zionist regime against Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will not sit idly by while extremist settlers desecrate Al-Aqsa Mosque, and we're willing to sacrifice our lives for it. The resistance will intensify, and Israeli crimes in the occupied West Bank will not go unpunished.
Palestinians maintain that continued Israeli violations against Al-Aqsa Mosque will only lead to more resistance against the occupation.
Israeli policies in Al-Quds are aimed at ethnically cleansing Palestinians and turning Al-Aqsa Mosque into a Jewish temple. As we rally today, we call on all Muslims to defend Al-Quds because it belongs to all Muslims and Arabs.
For decades, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for justice and freedom.
We came out today to support Al-Aqsa Mosque and the resistance in the occupied West Bank. Al-Quds is in our heart, and we will always fight for the sake of Al-Quds. Al-Quds needs real action from all Muslims in order to protect it.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967. While Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of their future state.
Palestinians in the besieged coastal territory say that they will use all forms of resistance against the occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
China says it frequently breaches world trends and damages shared interests of its members. Chalmers made the statement in his first report on U.S. compliance with WTO commitments. The ministry said U.S. has been pursuing an America First policy for 6 years at the expense of others. It cited Washington's abuse of export controls and sanctions to hinder other countries' development. The report referred to a vast array of U.S. self-serving actions, such as blocking of appointments to the WTO appellate body, which led to its paralysis. China also noted that U.S. is selectively implementing rulings of WTO's dispute settlement body. China's Ministry of Commerce said the report aims to urge U.S. to shoulder responsibilities and safeguard the multilateral trading system. Anti-France sentiments are fast growing across the Sahel region. Now, thousands of people rallied near a French military base in coup-hit Niger, calling for the withdrawal of forces. Protesters on the outskirts of the capital, Niamey, shouted down with France and down with ECOWAS. They said the West African regional bloc is not independent and is being manipulated by France. ECOWAS leaders have approved deployment of a standby force in efforts to reinstate Niger's deposed pro-Western leader. And France has pledged to give full support to all conclusions of the West African leaders. A former colonial power, France currently has around 1,500 personnel in Niger. That it's also its last outpost in the Sahel region after being forced out of both Mali and Burkina Faso in the wake of military coups since 2020. An Iranian parliamentary delegation is in Beirut to hold talks with Lebanese lawmakers and other Lebanese and Palestinian figures. A delegation is led by head of the National Security and Foreign Policy Commission of Iran's parliament. Our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, reports.
Head of the Iranian parliament's National Security and Foreign Policy Commission, Vahid Jalalzadeh, is leading a parliamentary delegation to Beirut for talks with top officials. The first significant meeting was with Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri. During their talks, Jalalzadeh stressed that the meeting was a chance to discuss the latest developments and express Iran's support for Lebanon.
It was an opportunity for us to reiterate the official stance of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We stand by Lebanon, both in its resistance against the Israeli regime and its struggle to overcome the country's economic hardships.
The delegation also met with representatives of the Palestinian factions in Lebanon and discussed the latest developments in Palestine, especially the occupied West Bank.
In this meeting, we discussed the Palestinian resistance and the deterrence power in the face of the Zionist entity, as well as the resistance operations which are increasing in the West Bank. Both the Palestinian and Lebanese factions underlined the significant role of the Islamic Republic of Iran in their resistance against the Israeli regime. We received guarantees that Iran's support for the Palestinian people will continue until the full liberation of the occupied territories.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been steadfast in its support of the Palestinian cause since it was founded. This is a strategic stance adopted by the Islamic Republic, and the Palestinian people and resistance movements understand this. Iran's support has been fruitful in the West Bank, and it will eventually lead to the liberation of Palestine and other occupied Arab territories.
The Lebanese Foreign Affairs Parliamentary Committee met with the Iranian delegation and welcomed the visit as part of efforts to boost Tehran-Beirut ties.
And it was a good opportunity also to share what we do as a Foreign Affairs Committee in the parliament and what kind of issues we deal with. So again, it's a very mutual and important visit that we'd like to build upon with all our friends, given our need for this support from all over.
The Iranian parliamentary delegation arrived to Beirut from Damascus and met with all Palestinian factions here in Lebanon. They have reiterated to the Lebanese and the Palestinians that their support is unwavering in assisting the people of the region to confront the U.S. Zionist prevalent threats. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Now, welcome everyone to our news review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland has appointed a special counsel in the Hunter Biden probe, deepening the investigation of the president's son ahead of the 2024 election. A special counsel is a Delaware attorney who's been probing financial and business dealings of Hunter Biden since 2019. This expands the attorney's authority and independence to conduct a more sweeping investigation. Under the current investigation, Hunter Biden faces criminal, tax, and gun charges, but a federal court has refused to accept a proposed plea deal. The attorney now says that Hunter Biden may be headed for a criminal trial. And now joining us for the program is Paul Sheldon Foote, Emeritus Professor of Accounting from Cal State University, Irvine, California. Welcome to the program, sir. I hope you're doing well, Professor. At what point does Hunter Biden's actions, or let me first ask it like this, okay, how does Hunter Biden's actions, including his allegations of criminal activity, reflect upon his father, Professor, and at one point does Joe Biden's actions become criminal in trying to protect his son?
As revealed in a recent testimony by one of Hunter Biden's business associates, then Vice President Joe Biden was directly involved in these conversations and, in fact, informed the government of Ukraine that if they didn't fire a prosecutor who was going after the corrupt activities of these events, that America withhold $1 billion of aid. And so by the end of the day, the prosecutor was fired. And look what's happened in Ukraine since. This is much bigger than Hunter Biden and Joe Biden. We now have all the people in Ukraine who've died, lost their homes, all because of deep, deep corruption in the American government. It's certainly, Biden is a big part of it. The estimates are that he and his family have raked in more than $17 million in these deals so far. Biden is certainly involved, but it couldn't happen without a lot of other corrupt politicians in the American government.
No, it couldn't. But why does it seem, Professor, that a lot of media outlets in the States, they treat Donald Trump and his legal challenges with utmost disdain. But when it comes to Joe Biden or his son, we see a lot of watering down. And a lot of the outlets make you feel it's a conspiracy theorist, what's going on with Hunter Biden, his legal challenges. But what happens with Donald Trump is very real.
Well, the sad fact is that a very small number of corporations own the vast majority of news networks around the world. I remember as a boy when every even small town seemed to have two competing newspapers. Now you have a very small number of corporations, and those people tend to be Democrats. And they withhold information contrary to anything that would hurt the Democrats and pound on anyone who's Republican.
And, Professor, do you think that Hunter's legal issues hurt his father in his bid for running re-election?
I doubt it. I mean, anyone stupid enough to vote for Democrats is already so stupid as they are going to say, all politicians are corrupt. What difference does it make? They're going to say Trump is corrupt. All Republicans and all Democrats are corrupt. So they'll keep voting for the Democrats regardless.
And now that you mentioned corruption on a more macro level, I'd like to point this out. With Trump in the middle of his legal challenges and you've got the Biden family, I mean, doesn't that reflect bad upon the American people to have two people running with both families mired in legal problems and in the courts with these kind of issues hanging over their heads?
It's a disgrace. It should be an embarrassment to Americans, but the average American doesn't pay attention to any of this, unfortunately.
And honestly, a lot of people feel, I've heard a lot of Democrats say that they don't understand why Biden is running for re-election. Apparently, he's not really, especially him and Kamala Harris, aren't too popular with the Democratic voting bloc. Why don't they entertain the fact of getting out the way and having somebody that may possibly be more likable with the American, the Democratic voters stand for the next election?
Well, that's true. Joe Biden is very low in the polls among Democrats right now, and Kamala Harris is even lower. I mean, it's an embarrassment at how ignorant she is. But at the same time, when I argue with Democrats, they always say, oh, but if it's not him, it'll be Trump. And they hate Trump so much that they're willing to vote for even corrupt Joe Biden.
And when we talk about Trump and his legal issues, how do you think that will impact his bid for re-election?
So far, it seemed to increase his standing in the polls. I mean, many Americans regard the actions by these Democrats as turning America into a banana republic. We cannot point to any country around the world and say that we're morally or ethically superior anymore. We are as bad as the worst.
All right, Professor. Pleasure. Time has gotten the better of us. Stay safe, and thank you for joining us for our news review program here. Paul Sheldon Foote, there, Emeritus Professor of Accounting, joining us out of Cal State University, Irvine, California. Thank you, Professor. Stay safe. That brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Riza, peace be upon him, has said, if you are filled with joy when you are with us, the Ahlul Bayt, in the upper reaches of the heaven, then be sorrowful when we are sad, and be joyous when we are joyous.
In the limelight.
The last few weeks have been dramatic shifts in geopolitical alignment in Africa, especially in Niger. Growing resentment over Western meddling has led to the overthrow of West-friendly President Mohamed Bazoum and the establishment of a military junta. But that's not all.
anti-Western sentiment has grown with demonstrators burning French flags and chanting slogans outside the French embassy in Niger's capital, Niamey. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted, the West has condemned the Niger's junta takeover. For centuries, France has maintained colonial control over countries such as Niger. A vast amount of resources are extracted from the landlocked West African country and brought to France, fueling its economy while keeping Niger's stagnant. The military junta has now banned the movement of these precious resources to France. France is naturally furious. The EU is already suffering a major economic setback due to its dogged insistence to let the Russia-Ukraine crisis drag on, throwing billions of dollars into weapons and resources. Now it's facing the additional burden of keeping its crisis-hit industries running, a glaring admission of the country's colonial practices to this day. With Niger banning the export of key natural resources like uranium to France, French and other Western media are taking to the internet and airwaves to smear the junta. The anti-Western sentiment has come to a boiling point from decades of Western abuse and hyper-exploitation of African countries. It is a completely organic phenomenon, and so the West will need to use its media apparatuses to counter and stifle the sentiment. Western media outlets have unleashed an aggressive campaign to accomplish this task, parroting the narratives of Western regimes. French media such as France 24 and Radio France Internationale condemned the junta while using fear-mongering tactics to draw support for Western intervention. They also sought to reaffirm support for French and other colonial structures within Niger, all while threatening the very people wishing to break the shackles of colonialism with military intervention. In response, the junta leadership in Niger moved to ban the hostile French media outlets. French officials blasted the move. The French Foreign Ministry stated, "France reaffirms its constant and determined commitment to press freedom, freedom of expression, and the protection of journalists." A European Union spokesperson joined in, saying this step is a serious violation of the right to information and freedom of expression. The EU strongly condemns these violations of fundamental freedoms. These statements should be a textbook study of hypocrisy. Time and time again, the EU and the collective West have unleashed mass censorship campaigns, banned outlets, and arrested journalists. It was only last year when the EU outright banned Russia's RT and Sputnik News. European Union satellite providers have also directly collaborated in media censorship campaigns. It has been less than a year since French satellite company Eutelsat removed Press TV from the air. Western countries brazenly allow media outlets that affirm their own imperialistic goals to remain on air and uncensored. This includes outlets that outwardly promote foreign meddling and violence. If an outlet carries water for the US and the EU, it will be allowed to operate without a single hurdle. If you criticize the goals of the empire in any way, you may be sanctioned. shadow banned, censored, labeled the state media. Your very website may be seized entirely, as has been the case with Press TV. For the crime of journalism in the West, you can be locked up in horrific conditions, fearing for your life. Does the West seem to have completely forgotten about their ongoing treatment of Julian Assange, who exposed the war crimes of the United States only to be smeared and pushed into solitary confinement? If you are aligned with the American Empire's goals, then you can even get away with killing journalists, and Western officials will try to brush it under the rug. When the Israeli regime occupation forces deliberately murdered Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Aqile, the U.S. dragged its feet to release a statement, ultimately claiming they can't say for certain how the shooting death occurred, though all evidence affirms that she was targeted by the Zionist regime troops. And who can forget Jamal Khashoggi, an American journalist who actually did carry water for the West, only that he angered some officials, so he was tortured, murdered, and dismembered on the orders of some officials. Instead of demanding any explanation or even condemning the act, the United States regime granted immunity over the killing. Freedom of the press is a mockery in the West, a joke with no punchline. Freedom of the press in the EU and the US does not exist, not really. Through loopholes, shadowy dealings, and outright hypocrisy, Western regimes always have the final say in what media can operate and what can't. It boils down to the simple goal of advancing its own interest. Knowing this, it should come as no surprise that Niger banned France's colonial media outlets. Their specific function is to carry France's interest in foreign lands. Their goal is not honest and objective journalism or asking difficult questions. Their goal is to maintain and push public opinion of their own regime. A more honest classification of their work would be regime stenography. France and the rest of the EU can condemn Niger's actions all they want, but ultimately they have set the precedent of banning media outlets. The West will go as far as killing journalists and then point a finger using that same bloodied hand at countries that refuse to give them a podium. Ultimately, the world can expect more of the same double standards from the West. The question is, if Western media's role is to carry out its imperialistic missions rather than question and report, then why should anyone allow hostile media to operate in their country?
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and on the eve of the martyrdom anniversary of the survivor of the tragedy of Karbala, Imam Zain al-Abidin, peace be upon him, we present you a wise statement from him. Refrain from lying in all things, big or small, in seriousness or in jest. For when one starts lying in petty matters, soon he will have the audacity to lie in important matters also.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, generosity with our family members in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be here at your service. We are talking about generosity with our families and how it is an integral part of our Islamic lifestyle. Now, of course, Islam very highly recommends and encourages every single one of us to be generous. Matter of fact, to be generous is one of the qualities of a Muslim, and it is one of the qualities of a believer. We have seen in the lives and in the biographies and in the seerah and the sunnah and the manners and the behaviors and the traditions of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, as well as the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, the divinely appointed Imams alayhimus salam as well, that generosity was a very fundamental thing in their lives. They were very generous. Now, of course, generosity can come in different ways, but the generosity that we are really talking about on the episode today is this financial generosity, this economic generosity, if you will. And we are going to be talking about how this generosity should be primarily geared towards our families. Now, of course, as we said, generosity is something which is integral in our Islamic lifestyle. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about generosity in our Islamic lifestyle, how a Islamic lifestyle needs to have generosity. We find that the Messenger of Allah and the Ahlul Bayt and the divinely appointed Imams, peace and blessings upon them all, have taught us to be generous. Now, a question here comes up as well, who should we be generous to, right? And so a lot of times we think, oh, well, we'll try to go out of our way to find somebody who is needy to be generous to. It's interesting, but in the traditions of these Immaculates and these Infallibles, peace and blessings upon them, we find that the first people that one should be generous to is their family. Meaning the right of generosity first is a right of our family members, our direct family members, whether it is our spouses or our children or our parents or our siblings. This very first level of family relations is the people who have a right upon us for generosity. So we cannot go out of our way, you know, to the other side of town to try to find somebody to be generous to when our direct and first level family members are in need of generosity. Yes, if they're not in need of generosity, then you go to the, you know, next level and the next circle. But the first level of individuals who have the right to our generosity is our family members. And of course, this is a very important part of our Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
On June 20th, 2023, Albanian police raided a camp belonging to the anti-Iran terrorist Mujahideen Khalq organization, the MKO, on charges of terror and cyber attacks against foreign institutions. Shortly after, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Nasser Kanani tweeted, "Due to their terrorist nature, the MKO will always be a danger to the security of its host country," adding, "This is why the Iraqi government expelled them and other governments refused to accept them. We hope the Albanian government makes up for its mistake in hosting this terrorist cult." The fact is, as a bloodthirsty group, the MKO is no stranger to terrorist attacks on foreign soil, and its dark track record in Iraq is just a case in point. Before moving to Albania in the mid-2010s, the MKO had lived in Camp Ashraf in northeast Baghdad, Iraq, for more than two decades under the aegis of the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. And before that, the organization had carried out numerous terrorist attacks against Iranian officials and civilians, drawing some 17,000 people to the jaws of death. In fact, the MKO's long list of crimes against their own compatriots made the group a trustworthy partner to Saddam Hussein, who was in an all-out war with Iran. In June 1987, that's less than a year after the MKO established its base in Ashraf, its leader, Masoud Rajavi, announced the establishment of its army at the service of his Iraqi godfather. As native Farsi speakers, members of the MKO army could easily infiltrate Iran's military forces, gathering intelligence on the front line for the Iraqi regime. The army also carried out tens of military operations against Iran. But the MKO mission didn't come to an end after Iran accepted UN Security Council Resolution 598, which called for an immediate ceasefire.
In fact, Saddam Hussein evinced even more interest in the group that had shown no mercy to its compatriots. It could serve as his private army in troubled times. The Iraqi dictator then equipped the MKO with an array of modern tanks, personnel carriers, and even helicopters, and trained its members under the supervision of Iraqi seasoned commanders. Up until the year 1988, Iranian civilians were almost the MKO's sole victims. But gradually, Iraqi citizens, including Iraqi Shias and Kurds, also fell victim to the organization's heinous crimes. On August 2, 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded neighboring Kuwait, seeking to compensate for heavy losses he had incurred in his 8-year-old war on Iran. But the Iraqi dictator had made some miscalculations. All his erstwhile Western and Arab supporters stood up against him. So he experienced a second humiliating defeat within a period of a decade, this time in a war called the First Persian Gulf War. The perception that Saddam Hussein had become vulnerable to regime change triggered widespread uprisings against him that lasted from March to April 1991. Initial protests turned into widespread uprisings in which both Shia and Sunni Muslims stood side by side against the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. Just a few days after the start of the uprising in the south, which is also referred to as the Shabaniya Intifada, due to its concurrence with the month of Shaban, another wave of insurgency broke out in the Kurdish-populated areas in the north. Against such a backdrop, the army and intelligence services proved ineffectual in the face of nationwide uprisings, and the dictator was in danger of collapse. But one thing changed the course of history to the detriment of the Iraqi people: the MKO army. The fall of Saddam Hussein meant the fall of Rajavi and his cult. So he deployed his task forces to Basra to infiltrate the protesters in order to identify the leaders of the uprisings. Because there were Iranian nationals, no one suspected them to be the regime's agents. The MKO members accomplished their mission, and within a short period of time, the leaders of the uprisings were all arrested and sentenced to death. Many more went missing for years. Their tragic fate came to light after the fall of Saddam Hussein and the discovery of mass graves. The MKO also helped the Ba'ath regime suppress Iraqi Kurds. Following Saddam Hussein's defeat in the First Persian Gulf War, Kurdish fighters took over Kurdish-populated cities in the north. In addition, they brought under control some areas in western Iraq. While the regime's ragtag army was busy with the uprisings in the south, the time was ripe for the Kurdish fighters in the north to go to Baghdad and topple Saddam Hussein. But here again, the MKO came to save the Iraqi dictator through blocking the Kurds' way to the capital until the arrival of the Iraqi reinforcements. According to the New York Times, Maryam, Masoud Rajavi's wife, told her fighters, "Take the Kurds under your tanks and save your bullets for the Iranian Revolutionary Guards," meaning the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. With the MKO's vital support, Saddam Hussein remained in power for more than 12 years, and with the group's help, thousands of Iraqi Kurds were killed in a bloodbath that later came to be known as the Anfal Genocide.
There are over 1,500 people buried here. They are mostly women and children. There are just 5 men. All others are women and children. They are Kurds from Kurdistan. We believe they are victims of Anfal campaigns in 1988 that Saddam Hussein's regime committed genocide crime against the people of Kurdistan.
The mass killing of the Kurds in the north resulted in the displacement of hundreds of thousands of Kurdish families. Many Kurdish women and children lost their lives to the cold and hunger, while many went missing. After the fall of Saddam Hussein in 2003, Iraqi prisons were the only hope for the families to find their missing loved ones. But as was with the case of Iraqi Shias, mass graves found in prison yards dashed their hopes forever. In 2003, the Iraqi people saw the long-awaited day when the senile dictator was finally arrested, put on trial, and sentenced to death. But as the main accomplice to Saddam Hussein's inhumane crimes, the MKO has so far avoided trial. Ironically, in recent years, the group has made democracy and human rights its new mantra, a desperate attempt to hide its ugly past. The raid by Albanian police came a few days after France banned an upcoming MKO rally in Paris. Has the West come to its senses? And will it stop harboring the terrorist group on its soil? History shows that the MKO is not like a gentle, caring guest, but a cannibal who can feast voraciously upon the flesh of the host with no remorse.
Imam Ali, peace be upon him, said, "The Lord Most High has chosen for us certain followers, Shiites, who assist us. If we are joyful, they are joyful. And if we are sorrowful and sad, they are sorrowful and sad."
In the limelight.
The British government has begun moving some asylum seekers onto a large residential barge on its southern coast as part of plans to use cheaper alternatives to hotels as temporary accommodation while asylum claims are being processed. Critics and rights advocates say housing any human being in a quasi-floating prison like the BB Stockholm is inhumane. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. The first asylum seekers have been transferred to the UK government's controversial BB Stockholm accommodation barge. A coach and taxis were seen arriving at Portland Port through Monday, 7th of August, as local residents gathered at the entrance with protest placards. Around 50 people had initially been expected to be in the first group,
moved to the vessel following several delays and rounds of safety checks. But Britain's Home Office later confirmed just 15 people were moved on, blaming last-minute legal challenges for the smaller-than-expected group. Dozens of other asylum seekers were initially selected for the barge but had their transfers cancelled after legal letters to the Home Office, which raised issues including mental and physical health issues. The Care for Calais charity said none of the people they were supporting, who include disabled asylum seekers, torture survivors, and modern slavery victims, had been moved following the challenges. The chief executive of Care for Calais, Steve Smith, said, "To house any human being in a quasi-floating prison like the BB Stockholm is inhumane. To try and do so with this group of people is unbelievably cruel. Even just receiving the notices is causing them a great deal of anxiety." Steve Smith added, "Human beings should be housed in communities, not barges. The government could just get on with processing people's asylum claims." Asylum seekers who arrive in the United Kingdom before March are being moved on board from hotels rather than directly from processing centres near Dover, and if their claims are not decided in the period, they may be sent back to hotels. One-page notification documents seen by The Independent gave recipients no date for their move or justification for it, and did not clearly state that the BB Stockholm was a barge. Earlier, on Monday 7th of August, Home Office Minister Sarah Dines appeared to suggest that 500 people could be on board the barge in the coming days, telling BBC Radio 4's Today programme, "Quite possibly it will be 500 this week, we're hoping." But when asked about the comments, the Prime Minister's official spokesman said, "We're looking to reach that number over time. I don't think we're aiming to do it by the weekend." There are concerns that being housed on the barge will re-traumatise people who survived dangerous boat journeys to the United Kingdom. And although the Home Office claimed suitability screening would take place, the criteria being used are unclear. Authorities and firefighters have issued formal warnings about inadequate fire evacuation protocols for the vessel, which contains 222 cabins lining narrow corridors over three decks. At least one bunk bed has been crammed into every room to increase the capacity to around 500. And the changes exacerbated concerns about evacuation routes and crushers in the event of a fire. In a report seen by The Independent, a long-serving firefighter called the BB Stockholm a major life risk and warned that most fire engines in the nearby area are on call only, slowing down response times. The Fire Brigades Union formally wrote to Home Secretary Suella Braverman, raising concerns recently and demanded an urgent meeting, but did not receive a formal response. Ministers were forced to insist the barge was not a death trap, but the transfer of asylum seekers was delayed by further health and safety checks. The quayside adjourning the barge is closed off at one end, with 15-foot metal fences and a gate separating it from the rest of the port. But the Home Office claims the vessel is not detention because people can take a shuttle bus to the exit. Amnesty International UK called it an utterly shameful way to house people who fled terrorism, conflict and persecution. Amnesty International added, "After so much shocking failure and clear warnings of public health risks about using disused military barracks, it is completely inappropriate for the government to continue its terrible treatment of people as objects for storage." The BB Stockholm was initially one of several vessels the government hoped to use as asylum accommodation, but ministers have not yet found any other ports willing to host them. They are part of a wider drive for alternative accommodation sites, including disused military bases and a former prison that the government claims will be cheaper than hotels. Even if it reaches its full capacity, the BB Stockholm will house under 1% of the over 50,000 asylum seekers currently being accommodated in hotels. The London Evening Standard has also covered the same story and tells us more. UK's Labour Party said the number of asylum seekers housed in hotels had risen by 25% since Prime Minister Rishi Sunak pledged to phase out their use in December. The Shadow Home Secretary Yvette Cooper added, "Rishi Sunak is failing to fix the Tories' boats chaos, and the Conservatives are just flailing around chasing headlines rather than getting a grip." She added, "This is the direct consequence of Tory mismanagement and their disastrous failure to speed up asylum decisions or clear the backlog, which is still at a record high." The barge is being managed by a private travel company under a wider accommodation contract worth an estimated £1.6 billion over 2 years, which the British media revealed was rewarded without competition. There have also been delays and legal challenges to the use of RAF Scampton in Lincolnshire, which is still undergoing safety checks. While some of the first asylum seekers moved to RAF Weatherfield in Essex in July were diagnosed with scabies and tuberculosis. The recently passed Illegal Migration Act puts a legal duty on the Home Secretary to detain and deport small boat migrants, but there are no operational asylum transfer agreements following the Court of Appeal's ruling that the Rwanda deal was unlawful. The government is fighting the judgment at the Supreme Court, but the case cannot be heard until October at the earliest and may take months to decide. Recently, the United Nations warned Britain's illegal migration bill aimed at stopping thousands of irregular migrants arriving on the shores of Britain is at odds with international law and sets a worrying precedent. The United Nations said it could have a deep global impact on the international refugee protection system. The United Nations Human Rights Chief Volker Turk and the UN Refugees Head Filippo Grandi said the bill is at variance with the country's obligations under international human rights and refugee law, and will have profound consequences for people in need of international protection. The two added, "It significantly erodes the legal framework that has protected so many, exposing refugees to grave risks in breach of international law." Reports suggest that ministers could be looking at alternative destinations and reviving previously dropped plans to send asylum claimants to Ascension Island, an isolated British overseas territory in the South Atlantic Ocean. Successive governments have claimed such measures would deter English Channel crossings, but numbers remain high, with more than 15,000 people making the crossing so far this year.
Midstream.
Have passed with its torments, oppression, and tragedies, while the families of the victims of the Beirut port explosion still taste the absence of justice. Since August 4, 2020, the families of the victims feel that the hands of their clocks stopped at 6:07 p.m. This is the time when the lives of loved ones, relatives, and friends were wasted. The explosion did not stir a finger in the Lebanese state, despite the protest movements and the continuous demonstrations of the families of the victims and the accompanying raids on the homes of politicians and officials suspected of their involvement or their complicity in obstructing the implementation of judicial decisions. In a statement, the Association of the Families of the Victims of the Beirut Port Explosion reminded of 235 victims and thousands of injured and disabled people as a result of the explosion, stressing that there is no